Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Lots of legal news. We talked with Ben Wittes yesterday, so we're going to be stacked up with lawyers. And joining me today on the podcast, Kim Whaley, who, by the way, good morning.
Good morning.
I see that you describe yourself as a constitutional demystifier, which I love. Author, law professor, former assistant U.S. attorney, and associate independent counsel for the Whitewater investigation. So those are pretty good credentials.
Well, they're relevant for sure these days, I think.
They are relevant. Now, I want to talk about the reports that the Mueller investigation is going to be handed in next week. Before we do that, though, we were just briefly chatting about your visit to the Supreme Court. You were actually there when Ruth Bader Ginsburg handed down her most recent decision on civil asset forfeiture. So just tell me, I mean, did you get a chance to see her? I mean, is she...
Yes, I did. I brought my students. I'm a law professor, and we had tickets to see the Supreme Court, and we got lucky and saw Ruth Bader Ginsburg issue this decision, and she's a celebrity these days. So I think my students were giddy with excitement to see this moment. We didn't expect it.
Well, of course, there's also, you know, all these conspiracy theories about her. This is the first time she's really appeared in that setting since her cancer surgery. I mean, did she look? Just give me your sense of how she looked.
Well, it wasn't my first time at the Supreme Court, and she looked as thoughtful and engaged and connected as ever. And she was quite lively during the questioning as well in the case that followed. So I think it's back to business as usual with RBG, at least from the perspective of people in the audience. She certainly was not at all down, so to speak.
You know, that's really remarkable. I mean, leaving aside the ideology and, you know, how you feel about her, what a remarkable woman for her age to go through something like that and be able to bounce back, you know, because I'm thinking that if that was me, I'd be, you know, I'd be sitting in my basement here in Mequon, Wisconsin, just sort of staring at the walls and feeling sorry for myself. And I'm not. How old is she? She's 80.
She's well into her 80s. Yeah.
And
that level of engagement, I don't think it's possible to really overstate what it takes to be prepared for Supreme Court oral argument from counsel's perspective, but also from the justice's perspective. They know the issues inside and out. They know the record inside and out. And because it's the Supreme Court, they're not just focused on that case. They have to think about the implications for the next case and the next case and the next case, because whether we like it or not, Supreme Court decisions really function like legislation because it's the highest court. So I think my students they remarked at how the lawyers were pounded by these really difficult questions. And I think the fact that Justice Ginsburg and the others are prepared for those questions is really says a lot at any age, let alone at that stage. She really is a remarkable person.
That is reassuring. Okay. We have to talk about what is likely to be the biggest news of next week. Actually, maybe the biggest news of the year. Who knows? We live in an age of hype, but the Mueller report has been hanging out for so long. And now we're getting these reports. Yesterday, CNN reported, and then the Washington Post followed up that the Mueller investigation is wrapping up and the Department of Justice is preparing to receive that report next week. Now, first of all, just give me your thoughts on that. I'm going to assume for the sake of this discussion that's true, that's accurate. Is this what you're hearing as well?
Yeah, well, that's certainly what I'm hearing. I'm just quite skeptical in the age of how the news cycle goes and the information coming out of various parts of the government. I'm always skeptical until it actually happens that we can count on it. But that is certainly what I'm hearing. And the big question is, what is the it? What is the report and how much of it is going to be public? And I think we might all be surprised by the dearth of information that actually comes out, notwithstanding my personal and professional belief that it should come out. But there isn't really a legal mechanism today for that to happen.
Okay, I'm going to get to that in just a moment. Yesterday, we were talking with Ben Wittes from Lawfare, and he ran through, I thought, you know, five or six very, very plausible reasons why he was skeptical that the investigation was wrapping up, including the various things that are still hanging fire, the fact that Don Jr. had not been apparently not been interrogated or talked to by the special counsel. Do you sense that, do you have any feeling about why this might be happening now? Is it related to the fact that Bill Barr is now in charge and has the ability to either, you know, affect the investigation or suppress the report? Are there any dots to be connected there?
Well, I would agree with Ben that it seems, people say 2 years, but that in this, the context of the scope of this investigation seems rushed, frankly. I participated, as you mentioned, in the Whitewater investigation under Ken Starr. That was 4 years. And then there were 3 years prior to that, or, you know, on either end with people before and after him. And it was a much smaller investigation in scope. This is not just interference with the election by a foreign government. We didn't have that in Whitewater, but we also have potential obstruction, which there were some issues there. But then we also have potential financial crimes. So I think it's surprising that they'd all be tidied up and finished. Of course, we also have the Southern District of New York and the District of Columbia. I'm comfortable with the notion that Bill Barr is a professional and is committed, presumably, to the rule of law. That being said, it is a little puzzling, frankly, to say that it's tied up in a bow and it's finished. So we can just speculate as to why. The other piece, of course, is that Rod Rosenstein is transitioning out, and he's the link that understands from beginning to end how the facts fit together, presumably. And so I would think he's an important component of making sure there's continuity in this process.
Okay, as of today, is Rod Rosenstein in charge of the Mueller investigation or not?
Technically,
do we know?
We don't know. Technically, it's Whitaker. But my understanding, what I've heard, is that, you know, Rod is still has a pretty strong role in it up until recently. My understanding, and again, I don't know this personally, is that Mr. Whitaker wasn't even read into the program, meaning he didn't have access to all the facts. But
that's good news.
That is, yeah, all of this, I'm so concerned about. Not if it doesn't come out of Rod Rosenstein's mouth or Mueller's mouth or a piece of paper that's filed in a federal court, I just think we all have to put a bookmark it and see what happens. We can't.
That is the key point. And the question is now, what are we going to see? How much are we going to see? Who gets to decide this? And I certainly want to give you credit, because I remember the very shortly, maybe it was the day that the Barr testified in front of the Senate. You were the first person to raise their hand and say, you understand what he just said, that he was basically establishing, he's not committing to release this report. And he's saying some things that cast doubt on whether or not we're ever going to see this report. So are we going to see the Mueller report, or what aspect of it are we going to see, and who makes that decision?
So, yeah, I did write that, and thanks for the shout out. I actually, after that testimony, I went back and reread for the umpteenth time the regulation that governs this process, and he said it himself. There are two reports. One of them is confidential. That's, I would think, the Mueller report, the one everyone's been talking about and anticipating, which would be sort of a summary of the evidence and what they found. And that's confidential under the regulation, and it's governed by DOJ guidelines. And typically, we don't see what happens inside criminal investigations unless it produces an indictment or an information. So that's report number one. Report number two would be if there's a conflict between Mueller and whoever was in charge of the investigation at a particular point. So, for example, if Mueller were to say, listen, I want to indict the President of the United States, notwithstanding the guidance that says that you can't, and we can talk about that. I'm not so sure that's binding. But if he were to say that, and then say Whitaker or Rosenstein would say, no, we're not going to allow you to do that, the fact of that conflict would go to Congress and potentially become public. But that's report number two. And if there is no such conflict, it's not going to come out. So that's how the regulation works. To your point, who decides this? It's Mr. Barr at this point. The regulations, kind of amazingly, are he could tomorrow amend them. Most of the time when an agency passes a regulation, they do it through what's called notice and comment. So the public gets to weigh in, et cetera. The regulation here is passed pursuant to a statute that gives the attorney general the discretion. So he could tell his team, listen, I want an amended regulation that gives me more flexibility. He could do that. Number two, he could just say, listen, under existing DOJ guidelines, I choose to make parts of it public, or I choose to do a summary of it. That's 100% in his discretion, but he's indicated that he's going to follow the letter of the law with the understanding that he wants disclosure. some measure of it for the public. My view is that Congress should step up to the plate and actually pass legislation that would, for lack of a better word, trump the regulation in our system of government. The Constitution is the top dog. Below that is statutes enacted by Congress in terms of the authority and the power they have. Below that is a regulation. So at any point, Congress could come in, as was the case in the Whitewater investigation, and say, you know what, we're going to pass a statute that basically nullifies or overrides mm-hmm. the regulation that now governs. And in that statute, we want information relating to what Mr. Mueller found to be made public. I don't see that happening with our polarized Congress, but that is really structurally, legally, I think, the proper outcome here.
And there was bipartisan support for some of that, but yeah, that does seem unlikely. So let's go. I want to parse this out, though. Mm-hmm. So what has the Attorney General said his intentions are? He's going to follow the letter of the law, but he certainly left folks with you were listening more carefully than most folks, but he left a lot of folks with the impression that he intended to make this public. So what exactly has he assured Congress that he is prepared to do?
My understanding from my recollection of it is that he said he'd give some kind of a summary report to Congress. So I'm confident that anything that would with disclosed sources and methods or national security, that would all be redacted. I think that would be typical. But I think what people want to know is whether there's sufficient information gathered by the special counsel's office to implicate the president of the United States
right.
in a crime. That's the money question. I don't think he has made clear whether that is the kind of information he would disclose. I think the problem here, and there's, you know, scholars differ on this, is that some people believe that the only solution for ensuring accountability for a president, sitting president, who may have violated the law is a political one. So that would mean impeachment. That would mean
right.
oversight hearings. But if this information is not made available for the impeachment process, then it's sort of a lose-lose situation for the American public. That is, can't indict him, can't make it public, can't give it to Congress for purposes of impeachment. I think that's structurally a huge problem. And it's also a bit troubling that all of this sort of constitutional weight is coming down to a brand new attorney general who's just on the job.
And we should, of course, remind people that the law governing Bob Mueller is different than the law that was in place for Ken Starr. You know, Ken Starr issued the report. It went to Congress. Everybody read it. That
right.
statute has expired. So there are different rules and regulations. OK, so reasonably in the actual world, what are the prospects that, in fact, the Mueller report will not be made public, either formally or informally? By informally, I'm obviously, talking about the leaks, either leaks from quote unquote the deep state, or through subpoenas from the House of Representatives. Does the House of Representatives have the ability, without passing a statute, to subpoena the testimony of Rod Rosenstein, Bob Mueller, or actually subpoena the report itself?
Sure, they have that power to issue a subpoena for both of those things. Have Mr. Mueller testify, have Mr. Rosenstein testify. I think the response would be potentially, no, you can't have this. And I think it would be a valid one for the following reason, which is typically, and we've seen some of these lines blur with this president, typically the system of justice, the Department of Justice, criminal investigations, prosecutions are not politicized in our country. They are kept within the professionals in the Department of Justice. And the idea is we don't want this information going to Congress because then this becomes politicized and people get chosen for prosecution or investigation based on their political views. That's the theory. So I think DOJ would say, listen, you can't have this, Congress. This stays in our coffers. The response, I think, would be what I mentioned before. At least, you know, a creative lawyer might say, listen, Congress needs this for purposes of executing its power of impeachment, for purposes of at least doing an investigation. We need this information to make a determination as to, even if it's not appropriate for indictment, if there's a justification for an impeachment process. And impeachment does not require the same level of evidence as beyond a reasonable doubt putting somebody in jail. So I think there would be a fight there, But like with many, many things, legal things and constitutional things with this president, there isn't clear authority for how that would come out. And so we just would have to see how the judges would think about it.
I'm just trying to imagine the political firestorm that would erupt if, in fact, the Department of Justice, you know, that gets the Mueller report and says, yeah, we're not letting you see this. We're really not going to give you this information. It's one of those things that I think might obviously, you know, if you're you know, the Trump base is going to go along with whatever, you know, ever the president wants. But I would have – I think the pressure, the political pressure, even just leaving aside the legal issues, the political pressure will be overwhelming.
I agree.
For them to be as transparent as possible. Now, you touched on something a little bit earlier that I wanted to follow up on. The Department of Justice guidelines have said that it is that you cannot criminally indict a sitting president. But that's simply the Department of Justice guidelines. Everything we've heard up until now has been that Bob Mueller was going to follow that. There's really no expectation that there's going to be an indictment of the president. Your thoughts on that? You expressed a little bit of skepticism about that particular rule and doctrine.
Correct, yeah. So there's actually four documents that I think bear on this. There is, as you mentioned, there's an internal memorandum produced by the Office of Legal Counsel, which is essentially the mini Supreme Court for the Department of Justice and the President. So these are elite lawyers who basically give guidance on what the Constitution means, because the President can't ask the courts, for example. That would not be justified under the Constitution. So they've issued a report under President Clinton that said, you know, you can't indict a sitting president. So their predecessors issued a report under Nixon, cannot indict a sitting president. Then, meanwhile, when I was working for Ken Starr, his team issued a report that said you can indict a sitting president. And Mr. Jaworski in Watergate issued a report, his team, you can indict a sitting president. And I've read them all carefully. And this is the issue. The argument for not indicting a sitting president is that president needs to be able to nimbly execute the duties of his office. I say his because it's been male for the history of the United States. So the ability to exercise his duties of office. And if he's worrying about a criminal investigation, he's being pulled off in ways that basically undermine his ability to function as an executive. This was raised with Bill Clinton in connection with the Paula Jones civil litigation. It went to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said, nope, you can sit for a civil deposition. It's not going to interfere with your ability to execute the duties of the office. The memo says, well, criminal liability is different. Criminal liability is harder. And even, you know, harder to undergo and at the same time function as president of the United States. The problem with that is a couple things. I think there's a difference between an indictment, an investigation, or responding to a subpoena and an actual trial. It's conceivable there could be an indictment that would either be filed under seal to toll the statute of limitations, to wait until the president is finished and then continue that. So I'm not sure that covers that. And the other piece is, those, of course, we saw both with Clinton and with this president, the investigation itself is so distracting that it sort of collapses that argument. I mean, the special counsel's investigation or Southern District of New York, we are already mired in criminal liability of the president to the point where I think that argument could cancel itself out. So I just, I'm not persuaded. For the president, I mean, my 17-year-old daughter, I had a conversation with her about this last night, and she said, does this mean, Mom, that the president could murder someone and there's nothing anybody could do about it until the next election? And I think that, you know, out of the mouths of babes, that's a logical conclusion to draw from this notion that you can never indict a president. And I don't think anyone would think that that's okay.
No, it is a legitimate question. And it is a legitimate question whether or not the president then is above the law, effectively above the law. And this goes back to the political issue, because I've seen polls, you know, showing the partisan divide on the Mueller investigation. But when you ask the question, should anyone be above the law? I think there is a broad consensus that they can't. Now, you also mentioned the issue of a statute of limitations, that if, in fact, a president cannot be indicted, then all the president needs to do in some cases, is to be reelected, and then becomes what basically is reelection becomes a get out of jail free card.
Absolutely.
That you can never, unless there is a sealed indictment that sort of, as you say, you know, tolls it, that okay, it doesn't go into effect until you leave office. That seems to be a very reasonable accommodation of these concerns.
Yeah, and I think that this just this is not something I think that is discussed very often, but it's practically speaking, it just heightens the importance of this next election. And that is, if those who believe a political solution is the only solution, the other argument is, listen, we have an impeachment clause. The impeachment clause suggests that's the only way to get rid of a president. There are problems with that, which I can talk about. But if that's the answer, then the next election would be another way to get rid of a president. There's under federal law, for most crimes, the general statute of limitations is 5 years. So that what that means, the statute of limitations means once it's expired, you are done. You're good if you're the potential defendant. You can walk away and know that that the government cannot prosecute you. It's known as a statute of repose, essentially. Like, I can take a nap knowing I can't be prosecuted. So if it's 5 years and the president gets a second term, that would be an 8-year term, he would then be protected by the office, in theory, by this memo saying he can't be indicted, for the full 8 years. So by the time he's out of office after 2 terms, the statute is expired and he cannot be prosecuted for potential federal crimes leading up to the last election. If he does not win a second term, that would be 4 years from the time he took office. There'd be another year that the prosecutors could go back from, you know, that mm-hmm. the 5-year period. Literally the day he leaves office and becomes a private citizen, he could get off Air Force Two helicopter on the way home from the White House and have a armed federal agents standing there ready to arrest him. I mean, I'm just assuming, of course, hypothetically, there's evidence for that, but that would be another scenario that they wouldn't toll the statute, but the day he left office as a private citizen, he'd be like the rest of us and he would still be liable for any crimes committed leading up to the election.
Okay, I have to ask you about Andrew McCabe and the various things that Andrew McCabe has written and said over the last couple of weeks. It is Thursday, so it feels like it's almost old news now. But it is, I think, important to step back, take a deep breath, and go, the man who actually ran the Federal Bureau of Investigation is now giving interviews in which he is suggesting that the president of the United States is acting as if he is a Russian asset. So give me your take on what McCabe is saying and what he's not saying.
Well, it is quite stunning. And I know, you know, of course, he's probably angry and has, you know, feelings around how things went down for him in terms of his firing prior to the vesting of his pension, et cetera. But it is absolutely stunning that someone who's a career FBI official and well-respected, I think, until this latest round of drama, would come out publicly and make that statement that he could be a Russian asset. And it's actually stunning that, according to McCabe, Trump ignored his own intelligence officials' findings about North Korea's missile capacity, saying, listen, I believe Putin. They have not denied that either.
No. I find that one of the most stunning anecdotes as well, that moment that he describes.
And it's not inconsistent with the mounting publicly available evidence that the campaign and people close to the president were in close contact with the Russians. People say no collusion. And then Paul Manafort's own lawyers, by mistake, disclosed in a public filing that he had shared polling data with people connected to the Russians. So why would the Trump campaign turn that over? To me, that's not necessarily a crime, but colluding in terms of communication, sure, it's all there. And I think what we need to ask as Americans is, how comfortable are we with a system of government where there's a puppet regime potentially actually in charge, where our votes don't really matter at the end of the day? I think we need to be extremely, extremely vigilant about protecting the freedoms of this country. And individual freedoms are protected by having an accountable government, full stop. I mean, what I say is, imagine a bridge over roaring waters, and we might have blue cops in blue garments one day and cops in red garments another day directing traffic over the bridge. if the bridge itself starts to corrode and ultimately collapse, we all go down, regardless of whether the people on the bridge directing traffic were are from X political party or Y political party. And I have deep concerns that at this moment in time, we have a three-branch system of government. The Congress is not functioning in its oversight capacity. So we really have a two-legged stool. And we're kidding ourselves if we think that the piece of paper, the Constitution itself, is going to protect us. There has to be, as you mentioned, everyone holding office has to be accountable to the voters. That's the only way that our individual rights are protected.
You know, I think the word norm maybe has been overused, but maybe also underappreciated, because your point is that, look, a lot of these things are thinner than we might have suspected. There are traditions, there are values, that there is the necessity of citizens to, you know, behave in a responsible manner, that it's not automatic. That none of these things are automatic. And if you erode these norms, if you erode the habits of, you know, democratic accountability, really bad things can happen. And we are not immune to history.
Absolutely not. I mean, the National Emergency Declaration is an excellent example.
Perfect segue.
Right. We might as well take out our black Sharpies and cross out the the clauses in the Constitution that give the Congress the ability to make those kinds of appropriations decisions. Likewise with the Emoluments Clause. If it's in there, but it's not enforced, cross it off. We've all driven down a major corridor in our town where we know there's a few blocks with a speed camera, and everyone slows down those two blocks. Mm-hmm. And then they accelerate again. And they slow down because there's accountability for speeding on those two blocks. If there's nothing slowing down a president or anyone in office, that power will just not only be amassed by that president, but that tool will be put in the presidential toolbox and handed off to the next person in power. It's not political anymore. It's about the rule of law. It's about having real freedoms in our country.
Let's talk about this litigation. We have a number of states that have already filed lawsuits against the national emergency. I'm guessing that there will be other lawsuits filed on behalf of property owners, other people who might be affected by it. How do you see it playing out? I mean, the president seems to have anticipated that he was, you know, going to be challenged. He would lose in the lower courts, and seemed relatively confident that he would win in the U.S. Supreme Court. Is the argument about the appropriations power of Congress, do you think that is the strongest legal argument against what Trump has done?
Well, I haven't studied the statutory arguments, but essentially there is, in addition, some arguments that where he's taking the money from statutorily, that is, Congress appropriated at some other place to allow, say, military construction projects, that you can't take it because this is not a military construction project, for example. So there are those arguments, but I do think, more broadly speaking, the constitutional argument is separation of powers argument is a huge one. There's a case called Youngstown Sheet and Tube from mm-hmm. the 1950s, in which President Truman, in the midst of the Korean War, there was a steel strike, and he said, "Listen, I'm going to take over the steel mills because we need steel for the war effort. We need to be, in order to protect the country in the war, we need access to steel, and if people aren't working, we can't get access to steel." Supreme Court said no, said that power grab is not okay. We can't allow a president. I mean, they had various reasons for it. We can't allow a president to do that. And here, this power grab, I think, is even less justified because the president himself has said it's optional. We're not in a war where we can argue there's a steel effort. This is really a political pet project. And I blame the structural problem on Congress, frankly.
Yes.
That Congress isn't stepping up and protecting the prerogative of that institution.
Yeah, that is stunning to me that you would think that the institutional jealousy would have kicked in there. Now, of course, when Truman lost that particular case, this was before the 1976 Emergencies Act, where Congress essentially did give the president statutory authority to declare these national emergencies. Of course, nobody's done it in quite the way that he's done it now.
Well, ironically, that statute actually was passed to consolidate a lot of little statutes that had given the president sort of over time a lot of power. And Congress said, wait a minute, maybe we've given him too much a power to declare a national emergency. We need to dial back. And in part dialing back, they included a provision where the Congress can vote on whether something actually constitutes a national emergency. Of course, the big gray area in the statute is it doesn't define what is a national emergency. And I think that gets back to norms, your point that I just think people have assumed. And I read a case in a Supreme Court case from the 19th century with my students recently where, you know, there's language out of the court just assuming someone who attains that office is going to follow norms, is going to act in a professional, measured, thoughtful, public interest oriented way, might have policy debates with people on the other side of the political aisle, but are going to actually execute the office with rigor, with thought, with integrity. And I don't think that assumption functions anymore today. I think we have to put that one on the back burner and say, okay, now what do we do to ensure an accountable government? Because an accountable government means no stormtroopers at my back door just because of I'm not speaking in a way that's consistent with what the president likes. And I don't think that's off the table for America. I really don't.
Okay. So make a prediction. Are you and I a week from now going to be reading the Mueller report?
My prediction would be no.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I don't know about 2 weeks from now or a month from now. And of course, always need to remind everyone that we really don't know what Bob Mueller knows, what he's been doing. He's, you know, it is remarkable that he has not spoken at all, and the degree to which his office seems to be leak-free. Also, the Southern District of New York obviously is going to be – well, I'll ask you this. I mean, it seems completely unaffected by whatever happens with the Mueller investigation. I mean, they're going full speed ahead on all of those other investigations, including the investigation of potential pay-to-play with the inaugural committee.
Sure, and I think that's important for a number of reasons. One is the witch hunt sort of rhetorical argument can't apply to prosecutors too. You can't just fire the person in charge, Mueller, and close the whole thing down. Those things are going on. And three, corporations, the Trump Organization included, can be criminally indicted. They're not protected by Article 2 of the Constitution. And so to the extent to which there's some accountability, even if it's not personal, but if there are some shenanigans going on financially with that organization or with the inaugural committee, it can still put pressure on the president in some other way. And I think what listeners need to know is if the report doesn't become public, then I think the need for a political solution for accountability becomes even more urgent. And that's up to every voter.
Kim Whaley, thanks for joining me. Kim Whaley, who described herself as a constitutional demystifier. I just love that and really enjoy your contributions to the Bulwark as well.
Oh, my. Yeah? It's a joy to write for you all. And let me just add on that. I do have a book coming out in June with HarperCollins called How to Read the Constitution and Why. It's a citizen's guide, the kind of regular language that we're talking about that walks through the basic provisions and how they function so people can be more informed and make their own decisions about whether this is a crisis or not. I look forward to that.
You probably should have your publisher send a couple of copies over to the White House.
Yeah. Okay. We'll do that. Okay. Courtesy of Charlie Sykes. Yeah. Okay.
Kim, thanks for joining me. And thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we will do this all over again.